Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name's Lana Nocticle.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
We get together on this fine radio station to talk about food, farming, recipes, gardening, advice, opinions. We talk about lots of different things here. This is Community Radio. This is the voice of all of us. We're all volunteers here and get along real good, usually. Yes, we do. And we get support from lots of nice people.
Yes, support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused, since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Thank you, Donna. Did you see the lunar eclipse on Sunday?
Oh, you'd have to be blind, dumb, and stupid to not see it. It was
you could have been inside. Like,
in a cave.
Watching, you know, you could have been inside playing something on your computer instead, I suppose.
Well, I think it's 33 more years or something like that until we can see it again. So I thought, I might not be around then. I better watch now.
It was amazing, and it really kind of gave you opportunity, a long opportunity, to stand there and realize.
It went on and on and on.
Oh, you stand there and realize how small we all are. And all these things are happening around us. That lunar eclipse was something
Plus
to celebrate.
The blood moon. Oh. You know, it's such a poetic phrase. People do say it. And, you know, what is this blood moon? So now we know.
It was red. I don't know why it was red, but it sure looked red.
Oh, there's some
red.
Scientific explanation that was kind of slipped through my brain.
It looked ominous. It looked lovely. And it lasted a long time, but I did kind of keep going out checking to see if the moon was coming back. It okay. Well, it's not here yet. It's not here yet. And yeah.
No, that dark phase seemed to go on and on and on. It was very interesting.
Again, gave us time for a little introspection. Today on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we'll talk about healthy chickens with Stacy Hartman from Small Potatoes Farm. Healthy food is important to all of us. We talk about healthy food here on the Donna Lana Kitchen.
And delicious food.
And delicious food. Chicken. Everybody, well, most everybody likes chicken. Chicken, eggs. But there's the bird flu to worry about now, and that's a wake-up call. We'll talk about that subject with Stacy Hartman a little later in the program. Also today on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we have a report on the chili cook-off that was held at the Ames Street Farmers Market. And last week, we talked a bit about apples, and I mentioned an apple book. I would like to let you know that I have taken the apple book back to the Ames Public Library. And that was the name of that book, which I highly recommend, is Apples of Uncommon Character, 123 Heirlooms, Modern Classics, and Little Known Wonders, plus 20 sweet and savory recipes. The author is Rowan Jacobson, and that was in the new book section.
And it's a really beautiful book. Lots of pictures.
Lots of pictures.
Lots of apple pictures.
Apple pictures, good stories. And I snagged a few recipes out of the back of that.
I actually ordered up my own copy, so we can be using it.
Yeah, we may hear some more about that. Yeah. Do you have a little bit of a herb drying update?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I just got the basil. I did lemon basil and basil, and I covered my dining room table with newspapers and torn up grocery bags and spread them all out as thinly as I could and ignored them for about 5 days, and they are starting to look very promising. In fact, I just remembered it's so easy. I have to say, you all would be foolish not to do it. It's the taste of your home-dried basil is much stronger than anything you can buy, and I'm going to do a second round of it. And I also would encourage, if you were the plan-ahead sort of person, because right now we still have it, you can still buy it at the farmer's market. It does make wonderful Christmas gifts as well. the homegrown basil, especially the flavored basils. I think next week I'll do Thai basil because you can't buy it in the grocery store. And then I'm going to make, I believe, some basil vodka and some shiso vodka and some more tarragon vinegar. These are so easy. And now is the time. Get it going.
Good. Sounds like you're thinking ahead and stashing it for winter.
Oh, it's way easier than canning and all of that sort of thing.
Good for you.
This is the lazy person's how to not feel like the grasshopper and a little more like the ant.
Good. Donna, you did a road trip this weekend.
Oh, I did a major road trip. I went to Salina, Kansas for the Prairie Festival, which I do, I can't remember, it's been maybe 15 years that I've been doing this. It's for the Land Institute, which is founded by Wes Jackson. They're about to have their 40th birthday next year, so it will be a really big whoop-de-doo. But Wes is a geneticist, and he is working on perennial polycultures. I love to say that because it just... he's basically trying to create a grain system where we don't have to rip the soil up every year, and we can begin to mimic the prairie in its natural state, which is perennial plants and mixed in together. No monocultures, no annual monocultures, which is what mostly we live in the middle of in Iowa and the rest of the country and most of the world, and is proving to be very destructive to having a lot of soil loss, among other things. And the problem right now is usually as a civilization goes into, as they call it, ecological and environmental decline, meaning they've worn their soils out or eroded most of it, feeding their population, they would just pick up and move somewhere else. Like, you know, the cedars of Lebanon that exist no longer, and the Middle East is a desert, and Greece used to be covered in forests, and these are no more because people used up the soil. And then they moved on to somewhere else. Well, we can't move on anymore. So we've got to preserve what we have. So perennial polycultures, which they've been breeding, and they have had some wonderful success, and they're growing this grain, which they call kernza, which is a perennial wheat. So I get to cook with that, and we made bread with it, and we made apple crisp with it, which was really good. And then we always have these big kettles of bison stew, which we serve to about, I'm betting we served almost 700 people this year. I know. Yeah.
Now, you didn't do it by yourself. You said there's a great bunch of people that helped.
There's a local people in Salina, which is a very progressive town. They have the Salina Resilience Committee, where they're kind of looking towards, okay, what can we do to make our town more sustainable, you know, energy, recycling, culturally, food-wise, because they're like Ames. It's a farming community, you know, in the middle of they grow a lot of wheat and sorghum there. So the Salina Resilience Committee is a fine group of people that, you know, show up on a Friday morning and peel hundreds of onions, and we roast squash. We get everything ready for the dinner, and it's kind of like a little party, getting ready for the party.
For 700.
Yeah, it's a major undertaking, and they have a big old Masonic lodge there. I mean, big. It's like 8 stories tall, you know, in this flat prairie town. I don't know how those Masons did it, but whenever they built it, it was monumental. It's as big as any of the churches in town, so they must have been running some kind of spiritual competition there. But the building is great. It has an old kitchen, well, an old-fashioned kitchen. It really, really, no modern conveniences there. But and then my wonderful friend Bill Ficus, the local Greek chef, comes in and helps. And he's lived there, I don't know, probably 40 years too. So a good time was had by all. And the Prairie Festival had wonderful speakers, one of which was Ricardo Salvatore, who it was a longtime Ames resident and is now at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And you know, there was a good showing by Ames. There was a van load of sustainable ag students and a van load of creative writing in the environment students, and a few other Ames people showed up. Fred Kirschman went along for the ride, and who did I say? Our best young farmers. Oh, Sally and Luke Grand were there. So, you know, it was a good community turnout.
And you mentioned that when all these people get together, they're dealing with pretty heady issues. I mean, they talk about feeding us for the future, and the fact that we're having maybe some troubles in the future and climate change. You said, but there was a different sort of tone this
year. Wes Jackson has always called himself Dr. Doom and Gloom. And the speakers change every year. And they're always notable scientists and social scientists and, you know, people, the deep thinkers who write lots of books and kind of ponder the fate of humankind, this kind of thing. And of course, we've had some very dismal years as things have gotten environmentally more and more difficult for all of us on the planet. But this year was particularly uplifting, and most of the speakers were actually saying that the voice of the Pope has really brought forward, in a position of power, many of the concerns that we've been worrying heavily about for years and years and years. And with his strong and clear voice in the encyclical, all of us are feeling a bit more hopeful. So,
isn't that something, how we wait for a voice that says what a lot of us thought for a long time? Was it Margaret Mead that says, never doubt the power of one person to change the world? Because really, that's how it happens all the time.
Well, it is interesting. We're obviously not getting it from the titans of industry. We're also not getting for their bought and paid handmaidens, our politicians. So, yes, it's wonderful that it would rise from the sort of moral and ethical sector that we have always looked to in terms of the world's religions. So it really was inspirational in that way.
Good. It was an inspirational time. That's good. And like you said, there's a lot of speakers and a lot of lectures.
And the weather was beautiful on the prairie, and then we had the full moon, and it was
Were there any talks or any speakers that you are looking forward to hear again? I hear this stuff is recorded for posterity.
Yes, it is. And actually, you can go to the Land Institute's website, and they do have a way that you can order DVDs or something anyway. No, CDs, I guess it is. Pardon my lack of techno, blah, blah. Fred Kirschman bought a set for the Leopold Center, too. So I am going to re-listen to some of them. And we may even find out if we can excerpt a bit of few things and play them on the shows later.
Oh, wonderful.
We'll check it
sounds
out.
Sounds like a wonderful collection of people, a wonderful collection of sentiments.
Good.
And,
we'll
and
take
good
our
work.
Inspiration anytime we can get it.
Good work. Good work. Yes. Oh, one more thing. You mentioned apples there, and apples were part of the food that you served, and the fact that you told the baker not to overdo the sugar.
I didn't actually. She just did it. It was perfect. She's this wonderful. I don't know. I'm guessing Amy is, 45 maybe or something. And she, you know, I mean, it's monumental to get the community together to peel enough apples for apple crisp for, you know, 600 or 700 people. And we're not skimpy on the apples. And then it gets baked up with, you know, nice bunch of seasonings. And this year, the apples they were able to get, of course, it's different every year, were kind of mushy in texture, but they had the really lively tart flavor, you know, that made a perfect crisp. And so Amy she's always, oh, I don't know if it's good. I don't know. And I tasted it and it was wonderful. And I said to her, if people tell you it's not sweet enough, you say we did this on purpose because it brought forward the flavors of the apples and actually the kernza, which we used instead of wheat flour, also. So it was less sweet. You know how apple crisp can be almost like candy.
Hurt your teeth.
Yeah. This was just perfect. And the whipped cream wasn't even very sweet, which was wonderful. I'm all for taking my sweet tooth down a bit these days. So it came out very well. And I said to Amy, just If they complain that it's not sweet enough, you say, well, we did this on purpose.
That's the cook's prerogative.
That's right.
Thanks for that report on the Land Institute Prairie Festival. I have a report here, too, from the Donalana Kitchen.
Oh, it was a big
department.
Social weekend here.
Oh, so much going on here. Yes. The Ames Farmers Market held its second annual chili cook-off, and this was even better than last year. It was wonderful. Lojean Peterson, the market master, shared this information with me. They had chili. They had taste testers. They had professional taste testers. But what was nice about it, they had
professional taste testers chili.
Well, yeah,
it's a good job if you can get it.
People that sort of were official, but then there was people's choice too. Everybody got to taste the chili, and there were winners, and there was a people's choice winner, and I saw the winner of this contest. It was so great. It was like a scene from the movie Rocky. There was this tall blonde woman waving her trophy, raised above her head, two arms raised, running in slow motion from one end, from where she got her trophy, down the center of the farmer's market aisle, down the center of the street, and just saying, oh, I'm so happy. And it was nice to watch her. She ran kind of halfway down. And that was Jennifer Knox.
Congratulations, Jennifer.
Yes, she run the first place chili, and she actually is one of the vendors, an occasional vendor at Farmer's Market. She has a booth called Salt Liquors, and her chili was called Roxy Gorilla Chili. It was a very nice pork-based chili that I tasted just by itself, but it was a pork-based chili with a pico de gallo.
Oh, pico de gallo. That means beak of the rooster, so it probably had a little peppy kick to it.
It was just right. And of course I tasted them all. Okay.
Does she sell that seasoning at her booth if anybody wants to recreate her prize-winning chili?
And we will probably explore that recipe in the future, but not on this show. The first place for the chili cook-off was Jennifer Knox. Second place with Jonathan Childress, and he has his chili was called the Triple Threat Chili. Third place was the Bear Down Chili. I don't have the name for that, but it was a spicy son of a gun, I tell you. And this is my favorite. The People's Choice winner was Eric Garrett with his Taste of Iowa Chili. And what was dandy about that was it had a really dark chocolate in it.
Ooh.
What a nice base. The chilies were all very, very different. There was made with all kinds of venison, beef, buffalo, pork, hamburger. And the one with dark chocolate was pretty darn good, I must say.
You know, we'll probably have to do a little show on cooking with chocolate and savory because it is a wonderful ingredient that people don't think to use without sugar.
Right.
But it is a classic Mexican ingredient, not just in sweets.
Very good. So that was the Chili Cook-Off Report.
Yum.
Thanks to Lojean Peterson. This is KHOI Community Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Go to some music here. Yeah.
back on the cool breeze in a place where I can be myself. Little bit of sunshine, put my mind at ease and take these dreams down off the shelf.
Back. That was music by a band called the Trout Steak Revival. Yes. And they are going to be playing tomorrow evening at Blue Stem, which is a music venue here in town, 3329 Lincoln Way at 8 o'clock. So look for Trout Steak Revival. That was a little...
Yeah, a little toe-tapping here in Ames we'll have tomorrow night.
Yes.
Okay, so this past spring, the highly pathogenic avian flu influenza epidemic hit poultry farms across the U.S. a lot here in Ames, leading to the death of 48 million birds. The bulk of those birds were egg-laying chickens, and there were turkeys, too. And now, apparently, it stopped because we hit the warm weather and the flu doesn't travel that well in really warm weather. But now the USDA is quite concerned that with the return of the cooler weather, which we're bound to get, that we're going to have another return of this epidemic. So we are going to talk about avian influenza flu.
We're here in the Donna Lana kitchen with a special guest. Today joining us is Stacy Hartman. From Small Potatoes Farm in Minburn, Iowa, she and her husband, Rick Hartman, have a CSA farm. They raise chickens. They raise lots of things. Welcome, Stacy.
Thank you, Lana.
And it's an organic farm, isn't it, Stacy?
It is. We've been certified for 10 years now.
Excellent, excellent. We wanted to talk with Stacy about avian bird flu. She had an article, which I guess was published elsewhere also, but I found it in the Practical Farmers of Iowa summer newsletter. And the article was saying basically none of the Practical Farmers of Iowa have had, knock wood, outbreaks of avian flu. And there are a lot of chicken growers, but they're mostly free-range chicken growers.
And
smaller flocks.
Okay.
So Stacy had a lot to say in that article. You want to start some comments that you had originally said that caught our interest?
Well, basically, I was summarizing the catastrophe of the bird flu and recounting some of the horrendous news stories we'd seen this summer regarding the extermination of thousands and thousands of birds. I think Iowa lost, 34 million birds?
It was just disgusting.
And I reviewed some of the outrageous news we'd seen, and I challenged people to really look at the situation. What was lacking in a lot of that coverage was the point being made that the big contributor to the outbreak and the losses was the fact that these birds are in confinement. And I wanted people to pay attention to that.
Yeah, and it seemed that at first the USDA kind of scrambled for any definitive explanation or definitive solution also. And, of course, they're thinking that with the return of the cooler weather, the USDA is planning for another outbreak. So there was an announcement lately from the USDA. The bird flu plan relies on speedy culling, vaccine, and I know they've hired a lot of extra vets to go around, and I don't know what the poor veterinarians are going to do once this I guess there'll be witnesses. One of the things that it did say in this article from the USDA was, if need be, the department said it would approve the use of ventilation shutdown for depopulation. You want to translate that?
Well, yes, that sounds pretty horrendous. But we saw during the catastrophe this summer that foam was widely used, where they would spray suffocating foam into the chicken houses that they call them, and actually suffocate the birds. This time around, it sounds like they're going to be moving more toward turning off ventilation systems. It's often hot in the summer. It's often warm in the confinement facility. The birds are very crowded. Turning off the ventilation system will, in effect, suffocate the birds within the building, and then they can be removed once dead.
Well, the USDA is justifying it because euthanizing by carbon dioxide or covering with foam are too slow. While not a preferred method, shutting down the ventilation could save the lives of thousands of birds by reducing the risk of disease spread. And it does say shutting down the ventilation essentially means closing the fans and all the windows so the birds die of heat stress. The USDA official told the Reuters News that the birds would die within 30 to 40 minutes. Now, the Humane Society is not happy with this. They say that it's a miserable and protracted means of euthanasia and essentially bakes the birds to death. So no matter how they do it, it's ugly. And then, I don't know where they put the bodies, but I think it was a problem.
It was a problem. They had, millions of birds to dispose of, dead birds, and finding
dead and diseased birds.
Finding landfills and places to take the birds did prove challenging. Some landfills did turn down the birds eventually.
Is that considered hazardous waste? We don't know enough about bird flu yet to know what's going on, right?
Well, if we watched the media, we did see the people working with the carcasses dressed in hazmat suits and rubber gloves and boots. So certainly there must be some concern. And many workers were offered a vaccine themselves against the flu. Some declined, but some did take it, and they were monitored for signs of the flu. So
I wonder if burying the dead birds what happens to the microbes?
Presumably they decay, but we have to remember, too, that a lot of these birds that were culled or killed weren't actually infected. Once they found the virus in a bird they tested, as a prophylactic measure, they simply exterminated all of the birds to stop the spread, which wasn't terribly successful based on the losses they...
Lana, you have chickens. You didn't have any problem with it.
No. And Stacy, you have a small flock of chickens?
We do. We have about 60 chickens, which we raise for eggs. Mm-hmm. And they're also free range, yours.
You too. So I haven't, except for the occasional knocking off of a chicken by a predator or good old age, my hens seem to be doing really well. Thank you. What about yours, Stacy?
No, we had no problems this year, and that was another bit of absurdity in the news coverage. There was a lot of mention made of backyard flocks, of people taking great care. I know in Sac County where they had an outbreak, they were actually going door to door near the confinements within 5 mile quarantine asking people if they had birds, chickens. There was talk about keeping bird feeders far away from your chickens, your backyard chickens, but we see that it was actually these confinement facilities that caught and...
There are mitigating factors. It says sunlight is sanitizing and helps to kill the virus. Another thing is foraging, which means only for outdoor chickens, on vegetables and insects promotes natural feeding behaviors and contributes to a diverse, healthy diet. Pasture rotation keeps the flock's living space free and clean, fresh and clean. And then lower stocking rates results in stress reduction and promotes optimal immune function. So are we to guess in an unscientific manner, as practical farmers, that perhaps overcrowding and undernutrition makes stressed birds in confinement facilities susceptible?
I think that's a common sense conclusion and one that was largely lacking in coverage of this.
Oh, yeah. The USDA is not going to say that. They did say one interesting thing, though. This was in the news today that here in Ames, we have developed the very first, with a licensed production of bird flu vaccine. And this is called the Harris Vaccines. They are based in Ames. They are producing it. It does work. It says, while the Harris vaccine has approved to be manufactured here, the company does not have approval to sell it. So we have it, but we can't sell it. The USDA is holding off on sales of the vaccine because foreign markets for U.S. poultry products have indicated they would ban poultry from any vaccinated flocks. So we are in a bit of conundrum. The way we're growing poultry on large scales is it's not working out too well, and the fix is a vaccine. But our multinationals that are buying our large poultry products won't buy it if it's a vaccine. So what's a poor poultry raiser to do?
Well, and who are the poultry raisers? I think it's important that we talk about that. Also lacking in a lot of coverage of the bird flu crisis was the fact that most poultry is actually not owned by farmers, so-called. 90% of those people raising poultry in confinement are contractors.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Approximately 10% are corporate-owned farms, and less than 1% of poultry raisers actually own their birds.
Of large-scale indoors poultry raisers.
This includes both poultry for eggs and poultry for meat.
Turkeys.
Oh, See, we eat a lot of poultry, and the idea of having a good, clean, reliable source maybe is a good idea to pursue.
Well, there is the problem of cheap food, which is also a lot of the export market, too, and competitive prices. You know, I must say when one goes to the grocery store and buys an 89-cent a pound package of chicken thighs, for example, that's obviously where you're getting. Now, do you sell chicken meat, chickens for meat?
We do sell stew hens to our CSA customers.
And how much per pound do you have to charge?
Oh, I'm not sure what Rick charges for that, but I know we sell our eggs for $5 a dozen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And the going price at the supermarket since the bird flu epidemic, I believe the price has doubled. It's probably around $3 a dozen or something.
Right, and that's another sort of odd facet of this story. We've heard a lot of hand-wringing over the skyrocketing price of eggs, but going from $1.99 a dozen to $2 or $3 for 12 eggs, which are highly versatile and highly nutritious, to me doesn't seem particularly outrageous.
No, when I consider, when you think what a miracle an egg is, and
it's the most perfect form of human protein.
And you can go out there and reach your hand under a warm chicken and realize that there's this miracle laid almost every morning by these chickens. And I often, if people ask, are a little bit leery about buying eggs from me at the price that I want to charge, I says, well, you just try laying an egg every day and see what it does. It really is a miracle, and it's important to pay homage to the chickens, but support the farmers that are growing them well. Stacy, what do you feed your chickens?
Our chickens are fed corn, but mostly they graze. They're fed a little bit in the morning, but other than that, they're turned loose.
And are they organic outside. Corn?
No, we don't buy organic corn. We don't have a good, easy access to an organic mill or mm-hmm. a supply. And it would, if we had to buy organic grain, our egg prices would be much higher.
Mm-hmm.
But we rely mostly on them to forage and to eat. This summer, they've been really enjoying grasshoppers and crickets.
Good job, chickens, yeah.
Yes.
In the winter, they rely more so on the feed that we give them. But they also get all the scraps from the house and all the food processing we do. So their regular presence in the compost pile. And
that's true. They're great compost turners.
They are. So they're always out busy foraging.
Chickens love greens. Chickens like everything. Chickens even like chicken. They are omnivores.
Oh, yes, they are. They will eat animal products.
Well, we found out this year they really like beets, to Rick's chagrin. So they spend a lot of time out in the beets, and we finally had to put a fence around the beets to keep them away, which surprised me because that didn't seem like something they'd be interested in. But
the beet greens?
No, the actual beets.
They dug them up and ate the beets?
They were pecking them at the top. So
they're an adventuresome little thing. Also, I don't have half as many chickens as you have. They're more like yard ornaments. And, well, they provide meat and eggs, too, but there's a couple of them that are always free range. They're supposed to be behind this big fence, but they're not. They get out and join me in the garden. They've learned that when I have a spade out and when I am digging potatoes or digging something, they'll be right there looking for the ground being turned over because they know that worms are coming up. They almost ride the potato fork. They're kind of, get away, give me some.
Right, that's definitely true. We see that a lot at our place. If Rick tries to spread a cover crop, they know, even if it's on the other side of the farm, they'll go and find it the next day. If we're weeding, there are several of them following behind us, catching the worms.
They're actually very clever, aren't they?
They are quite clever. And it's also should be pointed out that a free-range egg from a happy chicken is nothing like a grocery store confinement egg. We hear that a lot from our customers. There are customers of ours who will not buy an egg anymore in the grocery store. I will not.
I don't.
They're completely a different product.
I have to say, from a culinary point of view, they're much more flavorful. And in fact, the freer ranging, the better. You know, I mean, there is a definition of free range, which is often that they have access to outdoor space, which is good. But in the case of like Stacy's eggs or Lana's eggs, they actually literally are outside pecking, eating. I know. Lana, what do you feed yours?
Well, we tried to get, and you can get it, since we have a smaller flock, we sort of baby them. We try to get non-GMO stuff, and it is possible to find. Through PFI, we found some non-GMO soybean meal for the winter and corn. And occasionally, we like to give millet.
Plus, you get lots of vegetable scraps, right?
Lots of vegetable scraps. And they're always very happy when you get. Well, just like you and I wouldn't want to eat just one thing all the time. It's nice to go out and help yourself.
Well, and the resulting egg, and here's how you can tell how well the chickens have been fed. The golden color of the yolk is incredibly different between a chicken that's had a lot of live vegetation. It's gorgeous. It's also much more flavorful. And I'm willing to bet, though I don't know that it's even been tested, I am willing to bet that there's a nutritional difference between, you know, the free-ranged, well-fed. I mean, obviously, I would think that a chicken eating a lot of vegetable matter, green, is going to have, like, for example, higher beta carotene in the egg or something, and maybe that's what makes them yellower. I think I always use them just because they're more flavorful. A lot of times when you're reading a recipe that needs a raw egg, for example, they'll say that you need to sort of parboil it because it might have salmonella in it. Okay, I, in my 30 or 40 years of cooking, have never done that. I've eaten a lot of raw eggs. You're eating really conventional eggs, there is a high percentage of them that have salmonella can be within the shell of the eggs. So there's a big prohibition on eating raw eggs for the
And often store-bought eggs are quite old.
Yeah.
I mean, the sell-by date doesn't necessarily reflect the fact that they've been laid months
They can
earlier.
Be stored for 6 months.
You're listening to KHOI Radio.
sang to me a song. Got a short time to sing it, and a long time's been gone. I'd rather be in a dark hollow where the sun don't ever shine than for you be another man's darling and not ever be mine. I never tried being lonely. I never tried being blue. I never tried being lonesome for you. Little birdie, what makes you fly so high? It's a strong wind blowing, it keeps you tangled in your stride. I'd rather be in a dark prison, reminded of your name, than to be your free and wandering wild up in your chain.
Back. This is Adonna Lana Kitchen. That was the song Little Birdie by the band Trout Steak Revival. We're here in the Adonna Lana Kitchen talking to Stacy Hartman about bird flu and chicken health in general. It seems there are some problems with growing poultry on an industrial scale. Yeah, so what's the solution? It seems like chickens are not a awfully hard thing to add to your farm or hard to add to your backyard. It seems like we should have a better balance of healthy chickens to people that like to eat chicken.
Well, I certainly recommend that people find a farmer who is raising eggs the way they like them.
Well, and I'd go a step further and encourage people who live on acreages or even in towns like Ames that permit chickens to go ahead and get a couple backyard chickens.
I think so. I've raised chickens actually in California.
They're much easier to care for than a dog. Really, they just need a space to be and be put up or in at night to be safe from predators.
And there's a lot that you can feed them. It's what American households throw away just out of their kitchen scraps can feed a lot of chickens, really, truly. And here's another thing. You learn a lot about life and death. Chickens' lives are short, even healthy chickens. And dealing with life, death, and what happens?
Yes, and they have a lot of predators.
Yeah, it's true.
Raccoons,
it's
foxes.
It's true. Wild. Oh, my goodness. It sounds like a movie for Halloween. Oh, dear.
You're going to scare people away from getting chickens now, Don.
It's a good way to connect up with your food system. Mm-hmm. Whether you do it yourself or connect up with a CSA like Stacy and Rick have. They have a CSA called Small Potatoes. And how, if you have, along with everything else that you grow, lots of wonderful vegetables, you keep these 60 free-range chickens. So if 60 free-range chickens are kind of farming with you all year, how many eggs are you able to provide?
Oh, let's see.
A week or?
Yeah. A week. Currently, we're probably getting about 20 dozen.
That's a lot of eggs. Mm-hmm. A lot of people can be happy with some good eggs. And I don't know if it's the same on your farm, but it varies. Chickens go through a laying period, and then along about when the winter comes, it goes down, it goes up and down, up and down. But there's a lot of eggs to be had out there.
They still lay some, especially the younger ones will still lay in the winter. And I noticed whenever there's a sunny day, they like to go out and ruffle around, even if it's cold.
Oh, that's true. The one thing they don't like is wind, but they'll go out if they have a clear space to walk, even if it's cold out. And that's another thing to remember. These birds that are in confinement raising or laying eggs are naturally exposed to light to keep them producing. That's a very unnatural phenomenon. Egg production should go down in the winter months as the daylight decreases.
Mm-hmm.
And confinement
gives
chickens
them a little rest.
Right, are
keeps them healthier.
Exposed to light
all the time,
year round, to keep egg production.
Oh my! Oh my! Yes. Oh my goodness! In other words, they are stressed in more than one way.
Well, I think what we see with confinement poultry or any confinement animals are creatures treated as simply a means to an end. And we're starting or have been treating food that way for some time now in this country. We aren't particularly attentive to how it's produced or how it tastes, what the quality is like. We eat it because we're hungry. And sometimes, and more often than not, we've been eating more than we ought to and the wrong kind of food. Farming animals and eating should be much more focused on differentiation and quality.
And enjoyed carefully. Paul Willis has a saying that I love. Now, Paul is famous for his pastured pork and kind of developing the Nyman Ranch protocol. And he says, "My pigs only have one bad day in their life."
That's a good way to look at it.
I wish we could say that for all humans as well.
Well, good. And on that note, I don't know if you saw the news last week, but Purdue Farms, one of the largest, perhaps the third largest poultry producer in this country, has just acquired Nyman Ranch.
Well, I have to say, Paul gave me a call because he knew I would be concerned about it. And he said, "Donna, I'm very excited about this. They have basically purchased us because of our humane standards, and they want to really learn how to replicate that on more and more farms."
Well, let's hope so. I think also a lot of these large confinement industrial ag corporations are starting to take note that consumers are paying more attention
to how their food is raised
and are wanting more humane practices at the farm level.
Well, it's true. Like even a few months ago, Applegate Farms, which is a large natural and organic packaged meat company, was bought by Hormel. Because these larger companies are seeing that these higher standards in food safety and quality are very much in demand.
So it's incumbent still, though, on consumers to really keep an eye on this whole situation and pay attention to what the corporations are
doing. Oh, absolutely. Hold their feet to the fire.
And do research. And unfortunately, to make good choices in this food system in this country, you have to be very informed. You have to spend a lot of time, in some cases, looking into things and making good choices and finding people.
And that's what we try to talk about on the Donna Lana Show, right?
Absolutely.
Well, yes, I encourage everybody. Ask questions.
And so as we gear up in this state for perhaps another fall bird flu crisis, please pay attention to the news and what's going on and really read between the lines and listen to what's being said.
And what's not being said.
Really need to pay attention to the situation.
Right, because the USDA is not going to criticize confinement animal operations.
No.
And nor are they going to critique it. I mean, because it's such a big, big, big business. They're not even going to question that model. So listen to what they're saying. And, you know, make your shopping choices carefully. Read the labels, folks. Just read the labels and ask a lot of questions.
Well, I'd encourage consumers to challenge the resiliency of the industrial food system. We need to pay attention to what's going on and follow up on your discernment with action. Source your eggs and meat from farmers whose practices are socially responsible, humane, and transparent.
There you have it, folks. That's the Donna Lana Kitchen Bird Flu Report.
Thank you for joining us, Stacy Hartman.
Thank you, guys.
We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. So, which did come first, the chicken or the egg? Or perhaps maybe another thought in people's mind right now, which is going to come first, our turkey for Thanksgiving or another outbreak of a avian bird flu sort of thing.
Oh, I hope we don't all have to have tofurkey for Thanksgiving.
Sorry, folks, I never have quite got the taste for tofurkey. Looking forward to a turkey. So, yes, and be kind to those chickens out there. They're awfully kind to us. Yes, they are. We have some upcoming events happening.
We are so busy in this town. Culture.
So much stuff. Oh, last weekend was the Octagon Art Festival. Beautiful day for it. That was on Sunday. And KHOI had a booth out in front of KHOI. KHOI was open for informal tours. This is community radio. Come and visit us. Thanks to all you people who showed up at the booth, and also to you people who became new members. It was fun meeting you people. It was lovely. So that was a good thing that happened on Sunday. Also, Lou Jean Peterson from the Ames Farmers Market asked me to remind you that, oh, more things going on. Not only a chili contest last weekend, but coming up on October 10th, that's two weekends from now at the Farmers Market, will be the contest for bacon, sweet, and savory recipes. If you have bacon on
your mind.
Bacon,
yes.
Bacon.
That'll be a good contest.
Do something savory.
I might have to call up and see if I can get in on the judging so I can taste it all.
Good. Nice of you to offer your services. I like that. So you can go to amesfarmersmarket.com and attention Lou Jean Peterson for further information about that. Tonight at the Ames Public Library, there is a lecture by Ray McGovern and Colleen Rowley, September 29th, 7 p.m., Farwell T. Brown Auditorium, titled, Is Peace Possible?
And tell us who those people are. This sounds like a good one.
Yeah. Colleen Rowley is a former FBI agent and whistleblower, and retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern will discuss current national security issues.
So we got the CIA and the FBI coming to town tonight.
Right. Of all topics, is peace possible?
At the library.
Let's consider that. Is healthy food possible? Is peace possible?
There's a link between these issues here, I suspect.
I think so, too, and probably the Pope would have something to say about that, too.
Yes, I'm sure he's blessing all of us peacemakers.
And food and chili makers, too. Yes. and next week on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we'll get Lana's report on the local foods potluck that was held at Brookside Park here. We talked to a lot of people about a really fine potluck, local food, and just what they brought. You'll hear it next week on the Donna Lana Kitchen. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking to Stacy Hartman about chickens, happy chickens.
Yeah. Yes, and then the not-so-happy chickens.
Yeah. If you enjoy this show, tell your friends. Remember, you can listen to this show at noon on Tuesdays, and also it's repeated 7 o'clock in the evening on Tuesdays, right after Democracy Now! So listen to that.
Or you can listen anytime you want to
by going to khoifm.org.
On your computer.
On your computer. Download or go to the Donna Lana Kitchen page, and you can download any old thing. But also, shows are streamed live. You can hear us all over the world. Yes, you can. We have some out of listening area listeners. Yes, we've had music by the band Trout Steak Revival. Thanks to Paul Hertz for heads up on that band. My name is Lana Nachtigal,
and I am Donna Prisgintas.
They've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We have excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. If you want to contact us also with more ideas for shows, for this and that, go to khoiradio@gmail.com. What's on your plate? Let us know. Eat good food and enjoy life.
My life is different, and even though we change so much, it's hard to